Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Ileana Douglas. She has starred in films like Cape Fear, To Die For, and Grace of My Heart, as well as a number of TV series and individual shows. And we're talking about her new book, Connecticut in the Movies, From Dream Houses to Dark Suburbia. Ileana, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this wonderful book.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Now, this book addresses two subjects that are near and dear to your heart. Can you talk about that?
Well, yes, obviously movies, and then Connecticut, and I finally figured out a way to get them both into the conversation. I wanted to write a second book. I knew it was going to be a movie book, and it always sort of percolated in my mind that Connecticut was never considered seriously for a genre of cinema, which I felt that it should be. So during COVID, I started to work on the book, and then in Los Angeles. And then the funny part was that, you know, halfway through the book, I found myself, you know, going through Zillow. Sorry about my dog.
Don't worry about it.
going through Zillow and at night, you know, looking for houses in Connecticut. And then that's when I realized writing about Blandings and, you know, was Mrs. Blandings.
So you're going to move back to Connecticut?
I moved back.
Oh, okay.
So I moved. So halfway through... Yeah.
You write about how weird it was to be writing about Mr. Blandings builds his dream house while you're going through major renovations in your house.
Yeah, that was really strange because I kept trying to tell, you know, people that, you know, they were like, you're doing what? I'm writing a book. I don't think they could understand the concept of it, you know.
That's a lot going on in your life.
Yes. A lot.
I think one point, is it right in your book, they informed you that mice were living in the termite nest?
Oh, yeah, pretty much. I was writing in the book. I said, why do they always want to show you things? You know, so I would be in my office, you know, with the pounding and the dust and everything and just go into my Connecticut world. And then I'd get a call on my cell phone, like, can you come in here? I need to show you something. It's like, oh, God, it's never going to be good, and I know it's going to cost me a lot of money. So, okay, you know.
Well, it's fascinating in your book of what you do. First of all, there's the conceptual Connecticut that Hollywood uses Connecticut as a stand-in for certain things. But then there's the actual movies that were made either entirely or partially in Connecticut. And then there are the people who've lived in Connecticut. And I guess the person I think about most that you wrote about is Katharine Hepburn, as you said,
of
is the ambassador of the Connecticut brand.
She is. I mean, she, you know, there was something I always thought, but then after writing it and researching it, I said, yeah, she really is the ambassador, because anyone who is doing, you know, Connecticut heiress, wealthy person, they do Katharine Hepburn. That's who they do. Even somebody like Irene Dunne, when she was doing this movie in the 1930s called Theodora Goes Wild, she copied Katharine Hepburn. And so you see that kind of again and again, that it's a certain, you know, it's a certain type of tight jawed accent that people think of when they think of Connecticut. But, you know, for those of us who live here, there's so much more. There's the great industrial past. There's the mill towns. There's the seaport, Mystic Seaport, the shipbuilding, you know, on and on.
You're becoming the ambassador of Connecticut.
I know. Well, that's because I want to make movies here. I think that's a great
idea. Well, let's talk about the country living comedies, because they include some of my favorite movies. You were talking about Theodore Goes Wild, which if people haven't seen, is a fantastic movie. It stars your grandfather.
Yes, it does. And as I mentioned, Irene Dunne. And the premise of all the country living comedies is usually a cynical New Yorker who's trapped in some kind of high society type life in New York, goes to visit someone in the country, and is transformed by, you know, the values of country living, and decides to, you know, change their whole life. And so that's kind of the premise of the film. And within the film, which is such a funny idea, is Theodora is writing under a pseudonym. She's writing these, you know, hot-to-trot novels, and she lives in a small town in Connecticut. Nobody knows that, you know, and they're all up in arms about this book, and she's actually the author of the book. So it also pokes fun at the kind of, you know, the social mores of small-town living, at right. the same time embracing small-town living. And that's what I love about all of these country living comedies. They all have that ability to make fun of the countrified folk, but at the same time say it's better to live in the country than the city.
Now, you did a screening of this movie in 2017.
I did. It was, I didn't do the screening, but I participated. When I was working with Turner Classic Movies, they were screening a very rare, what's called a nitrate print of the film. So it's just absolutely beautiful print, and they asked me to introduce it. And I was really talking up the movie, as you know, so I was hoping it was going to go over well, because it's rather an unusual screwball comedy. And what I wanted to point out was the realism in the film, and which stems from the director Richard Boleslawski, who, as I write in the book, was he taught Stanislavski acting. He was in Connecticut in the 1930s, along with people like Ilya Kazan and Lee Strasberg and Harold Clurman. And basically, they started what we now know as, you know, modern method acting. And so the film is very unusual because it's very naturalistic.
Mm.
And the movie just went over like gangbusters. I was really tickled by this idea that my grandfather was in it. And as I left the theater, you know, just I remembered that experience. And so, again, part of writing the book, I said I somehow have to include this, this experience into the book, this wonderful memory I had.
Well, that's one of the really enjoyable things about this book, is that there you have summaries of each film. But then you also have all these interesting tidbits of information and digressions that really make the book really fun to read.
Thank you.
Let's talk about Bringing Up Baby. Speaking of Katharine Hepburn, 1938, how can you not like this movie? But some of the things I learned about it in your book, it was just incredible that the inspiration for David Huxley was O.C. Marsh from Yale.
Yes. that was news to me, too, you know. I mean, the phrase, it's a cliche when you say the book is almost writing itself, but it almost began to write itself, because I couldn't believe how many ties to great Hollywood films did, in fact, have more than a casual connection to Connecticut. And here you have, you know, the man who invented the phrase Brontosaurus. The whole plot of the film revolves him being a paleontologist and putting together, you know, his Brontosaurus, which is in the Peabody Museum in New Haven. In fact, I was so disappointed, because when I was doing the book, although I did find a picture postcard of the Brontosaurus, the actual museum was closed and still is closed. It's under renovation. And I found the picture of Marsh. But there's one of the characters in the movie is named Peabody. So there's all sorts of little hints that it is, in fact, from Connecticut. And a lot of these movies, too, they use as a punchline. And they always use Bridgeport. It's always, I guess, because it sounds sort of funny. It always, at one point or another, somebody says, you know, I came in on a train from Bridgeport.
You write that, you know, the big country house that's in Bringing Up Baby was what moviegoers imagined all Connecticut houses were like.
Yes.
And I can see that. It was.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, Connecticut was the idyllic, like, suburb.
Yes.
And country. And so everybody's going to have these huge, lavish houses.
So when you see the film, Howard Hawks' wife saw the film and asked that her house be decorated in the style of that film, which, you know, there were times in the book, I always say it's like, it was like a road trip. And I sometimes, like, I would take such a deep dive. I could have done a whole chapter, which I thought about, for the production design of these films, where it took off in Hollywood, and it is part of what they call, you know, colonial revival, which is the 1930s version of revolutionary. But again, even that isn't really accurate. It's Hollywood sort of version, which is kind of California. It could almost be, again, a new type of decoration, because, and it's all within that movie. It's stone walls and big beams and, you know, braided rugs. And, you know, it's really fascinating. And you get to see quite a bit of the house in Bringing Up Baby. Yeah. And that was another revelation that I had in all these movies, which specifically take place in Connecticut. You see a lot of the house, even if it's a house that's created, you know, in Hollywood. So they really are selling this idea of Connecticut. You know, I noticed that in two of the films, like in Holiday Inn and Christmas in Connecticut, everybody, even though it's the 40s, everybody arrives in a horse and carriage, you know.
That's right.
I think it's the 40s, though. I think we would have cars.
Well, the cars only go so far in Connecticut in the 40s.
Yeah. But there's a big picture window. You know, there are certain tropes in every. There's a gigantic fire. There's a fireplace that's as big as a living room, you know, that people sit around. It's just these fun little things you see in film after film after film.
Now, there's a dark side of Bringing Up Baby, and that's that Katharine Hepburn really got sort of screwed after this film. The RKO honchos really, they were watching the dailies and they hated her.
Yeah, which is so interesting. That's why I wanted to write about her being, you know, the very essence of who she was, which is she wears pants, her hair is kind of unruly, she's pushing the guy around, you know, they hate it. And so, in a sense, what you see in Bring a Baby, which later on was embraced, is Connecticut. You see all the traits of people that we admire that are from Connecticut, a sense of independence, a sense of not really caring how you look, a sense of, you know, values, sportsmanlike, you know, she's an outdoor girl, all of these qualities that the Hollywood studios, you know, didn't really like. But her revenge was that, you know, she went back to Broadway and did, you know, got the rights for the Philadelphia Story and came back and was, you know, and from that point on, her career, you know, sort of a juggernaut.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is actress and film historian Ileana Douglas. She's been in many movies, including things like Cape Fear, To Die For, Grace of My Heart, and as well as a number of TV series. But we're talking about her new book. And not only is it interesting to read, it's pretty sumptuous visually. It's got a lot of interesting photographs in it. Connecticut in the Movies. From dream houses to dark suburbia. We were talking about houses. You write about Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House, 1948, with Cary Grant and Myrna Loy. There was a weird promotion that had to do with that film, where 73 replicas of the Blandings house were sold as kits across the country.
Yes. Isn't that a wonder? You know, so...
that's really expensive.
Well... I mean, it worked. You know, that was one of the great. So you go from, you know, what's interesting about this book as a road trip book is you go from okay, it's a nice living room with a big fireplace, and yes, they may be selling this idea. And then it's like, no, let's build a whole house. Like, let's have the whole, let's sell the idea of superior living in Connecticut. And that's what I wanted to point out. Not New Jersey, not Westchester, not any other suburban borough, but Connecticut. It was almost unknown enough that you could create this ideal, but its roots are all true. Wow. The writer Eric Hodgins was from New Milford, was living in New Milford, and he wrote Mr. Blandings based on his own experience of, trying to renovate a house. It went way over budget. He went completely bankrupt. Eventually, he had to sell the house because they had sunk so much money into it. And then, sadly, when they sold the rights, which the rights were sold to his neighbor, the producer Dori Sherry, he was the one who got my grandfather involved. But then the owners of his house wouldn't sell it back to him. But what I love about the film and this idea of Blanding's houses all over the country is that they do bear a striking resemblance to the original New Milford house, although it's been modified again and again and again. But it is, when we think of a classic American house, this is what we think of. We think of a white, clappered house with shutters, with a long drive up. And where is that house? It's in Connecticut. So that the movie created this sort of fantasy. And so when I went to look at, I found two of the houses that are here in Connecticut, and they're all over the country. There's many of them are still around, and you could get, they sold, the plans. So you could buy the plans for this house, and you could live in a house just like the house that, Cary Grant and Myrna Loy lived in. But, the message of the film, I love the film. There's never been a better film about, the pitfalls of home renovation and how funny it is.
And Myrna Loy is amazing in that movie.
She's amazing. She's in scenes where she's not even saying anything, just her little looks or a little squeak.
The discussion about the paint color, though, it kills me.
Yeah, it's a classic. I mean, there's so many relatable scenes in the film, and they represent for everybody. What I think is interesting about my grandfather's character is he's the guy who's against it. But by the end of the movie, the message of the movie is pure consumerism. It's like, just keep spending and spending, and somehow it'll all work out because we all deserve to have a dream house. And I think it comes from that film, selling us on this idea of suburbia. Getting out of New York, not being cramped in by your neighbors. But at the same time, the film is wickedly funny in terms of how shrewd the Yankees are and how dumb the New Yorkers are. And I think that, again, that's part of the fun of the film. And I can tell you from personal experience, it's still going on. it was happening to me. I was like, wait a minute, I'm writing about these kind of guys, and it's happening to me. So I still think there is this kind of, so you move from the city, huh? Okay.
And that's why the mice are living in your termite holes. You were talking about this. You write that... this is one of the first movies to have massive cross promotions and merchandise tie-ins.
Massive.
Including General Electric had the first home dishwasher in this movie.
Yes. In fact, again, this was a movie where there were certain cornerstones in the, when I was laying out what the book was going to be. This is really, I think of everything as a movie. And in a sense, this is the end of Act One. is like everything leads up to Blandings. And I could have almost done a whole book about Blandings because it really, I just think it's so important in terms of post-war suburbia. And no other film sells us on commercialism in a fun way.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the way the movie does. And it is wall-to-wall commercials, but it's, you know, we think this is a modern idea, but it was one of the first films to really take advantage of, you know, Cary Grant is driving a Ford and they're eating Kellogg's cereal and he's, you know, he's working on an advertising account, you know, for this, you know, Wham Ham. So everything in the movie is kind of an advertisement. And the when they went out on tour, I couldn't believe the amount. I mean, it could have been a whole book. Silverware, carpets, drapes.
Wow.
Literally, you know, we were talking about appliances. And I wrote in the book that GE, when they saw the movie, was unhappy that they didn't see enough of the kitchen. So they had to go back and shoot a scene where you could see, you know, a little bit more of the appliances.
Wow. Okay, we're gonna run out of time because I want to talk. There's a movie I really want to talk about, and that's the one that's on your cover, The Swimmer, 1968. And this is in the section of dark suburbia. And so as you move into the 60s, the Connecticut suburbs become an area of real sort of interesting stuff going on. A lot of sexual overtones, a lot of dark stuff. But The Swimmer, it's a movie I saw it when it first came out in 68. And it's a movie that's just always stayed with me. I know that it's a flawed film, but it's a really interesting film.
Oh, yeah. It gets better every time you see it.
Yeah, it does, and especially as you get older.
I there are so many things in it. Well, you know, I recommend that everybody read the John Cheever short story, and the, you know, because it is really about this kind of this, you know, world that really only seems to exist, I think, kind of in Connecticut, you know, kind of upper class. His impressions of where he's living are kind of fascinating within itself. But then the movie, Frank Perry, was just so great at doing these kind of, you know, dark suburbia films. And actually, it's interesting because Burt Lancaster's birthday today. So I'm always thrilled to be talking about Burt Lancaster. But the movie is, this is, as I said, if the book is broken down and it's act one, the end of act two is The Swimmer, because it's now that we're in suburbia, it begins the deconstruction of suburbia.
Yeah.
So it's all about misplaced values, and The Swimmer culminates with a lot of movies that I write about before it, The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit,
yep.
Gentleman's Agreement, Boomerang. They're all about cracks that are starting to appear. Now, like, gee, maybe it's not as idyllic as I thought. Maybe there's some anti-Semitism here. Maybe there's some crooked politics, you know?
And right.
It's you start to feel the ground underneath you is maybe not quite as all-American as we thought, and it sort of culminates with The Swimmer, is that now all the things that we promoted in Mr. Blandings, a house in the country, a nice house, nice things, they're all being examined now, and through this character, Ned Merrill, who at the beginning of the movie, you know, we come to realize that he has lost his place in society, and he's going to be punished for that. And it's a very interesting examination of his fall from grace, and in a way that is, you know, treacherous. The poster, I have the poster. It says, when you see, I mean, the movie was a huge failure.
And
the poster says, when you see The Swimmer, we think of yourself. You know, I don't think anybody wants to think of themselves as a failure.
Well, by the end of the movie, as you write about in the book, he's essentially become a ghost of himself.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean,
he never
And it's just amazing through the course of the book, watching the deterioration of Ned Merrill, Burt Lancaster. He does it, and he puts it all out there.
Oh, it's a you know, as I write, it's a stripped down, literally stripped down deconstruction of himself, of his own larger than life persona. And I found it interesting. You know, when I write, I write about the things that are like, oh, that's interesting. You know, he was 50 years old.
Yep.
He was going through a divorce. He desperately wanted this part, which is not the most flattering kind of Burt Lancaster part. So you get the feeling like, okay, like he wanted to go there. He wanted to like go there and do this film, and he was involved as a producer. So I think that, you know, it was before the time where we now talk in depth to actors about, oh, what were you doing here? But to me, it is most definitely a deconstruction of his own persona. And one of the things I thought was really strange about it was he's wearing swimming trunks that are literally a replica of the same swimming trunks that he wore in From Here to Eternity.
Whoa.
And, you know, in scene after scene, but the one of the most upsetting scenes in the movie, he decides he's going to swim. You know, is this fantasy? It's a youthful fantasy.
Ileana, we're completely out of time.
Oh, I can't believe. Well, you just have to see the movie and then have me.
You
got to
get the book. No, Ileana, first you get the book. First you get Connecticut in the movies. Then read the book, read John Cheever's book, then go see the movie.
And then go come back. Yes.
We could have talked forever just about that film, and there were so many other films I wanted to talk about. By the way, there's so much else that's in this book that are just amazing, including a complete list of Hallmark movies that are talking about Connecticut. I love the fact that you included that. Thank you.
Oh, you have to.
We've been talking with my guest tonight, film historian, actress Ileana Douglas. She's been in many movies, including some of my favorites, Cape Fear, To Die For. I love that movie. Grace of My Heart. I love that movie, too, as well as a number of TV series. But we were talking about her new book, Connecticut in the Movies, From Dream Houses to Dark Suburbia. It is a wonderful book, and it's a beautiful book, too. So that's a plus. Ileana, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you so much. Have a great day.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.